Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear reports from Jill Robbins and Anna Mateo. Dan Novak presents this week's education report. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly tells us about the presidency of Rutherford B. Hayes. But first, here is Jill Robbins.
U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi arrived in Taiwan late Tuesday, despite threats of strong measures from China. Pelosi became the highest-level American official to visit the self-ruled island claimed by China in 25 years. The trip could increase tension between the U.S. and China, which claims the island as part of its country. Pelosi and other lawmakers traveled to Taiwan in a U.S. military airplane. The group landed at Taipei's airport and was met by Taiwan's foreign minister, Joseph Wu, and Sandra Oudkirk, the top U.S. representative in Taiwan. Pelosi is on a trip to Asia that includes announced visits to Singapore, Malaysia, South Korea, and Japan. Her stop in Taiwan had not been announced, but had been expected. The speaker said in a statement shortly after landing that the visit was to honor America's commitment and to support Taiwan. She said, "America's solidarity with the 23 million people of Taiwan is more important today than ever, as the world faces a choice between autocracy and democracy." China has repeatedly warned of strong measures if Pelosi went ahead with the trip. On Tuesday, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said in a statement that U.S. politicians who play with fire on the Taiwan issue will come to no good end. And China's defense ministry said it would conduct targeted military operations to safeguard national sovereignty. U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said earlier on Monday that members of Congress have regularly visited the island over the years. He added, "There is no reason for China to use it as a pretext to increase aggressive military activity in or around the Taiwan Strait." Shortly before Pelosi arrived in Taiwan, Chinese state media said Chinese Su-35 fighter jets were crossing the Taiwan Strait, the body of water that separates mainland China and Taiwan. Reuters news agency reported that several Chinese warships have also sailed near the unofficial dividing line of the strait since Monday and remained there. A U.S. Navy official told Reuters that four U.S. warships, including the aircraft carrier USS Ronald Reagan, were in the waters east of Taiwan on what the U.S. Navy called routine deployments. Taiwan's defense ministry said it observed military activities near Taiwan and that it would send forces, if needed, to deal with enemy threats. In the capital city of Taipei, two tall buildings are lit up with words of welcome, which said, "Welcome to Taiwan, Speaker Pelosi." Pelosi is a longtime critic of China's human rights records. She was a newly elected lawmaker when Chinese tanks crushed the 1989 pro-democracy student protest in Tiananmen Square. 2 years later, she joined other lawmakers at the square with a large sign that read, "To those who died for democracy in China." In 2009, she hand-delivered a letter to then-President Hu Jintao calling for the release of political prisoners. On Wednesday, Pelosi will meet with Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen and human rights activists. I'm Jill Robbins.
Russian, French, and American leaders are traveling across Africa to win support for their country's positions on the war in Ukraine. Experts say it is the most intense competition for influence in Africa since the Cold War, when the former Soviet Union and the West sought closer ties with the continent. Last week, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and French President Emmanuel Macron began visiting several African countries. Samantha Power is head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. She went to Kenya and Somalia in July. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, is expected to go to Ghana and Uganda soon. Lavrov has been traveling across Africa, where many countries are suffering from food shortages. He sought to blame rising food prices on Western countries because they placed trade restrictions on Russia over its war in Ukraine. Western leaders have accused Russia of using food as a weapon. They have also accused Russia of fighting a war to gain more territory. Russia has been working to win support in Africa for several years. President Vladimir Putin has tried to strengthen relationships that are more than 50 years old. At that time, the Soviet Union supported many African movements, fighting to push out European colonial rulers. The United Nations vote to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine demonstrated some of Russia's influence in Africa. 28 African nations voted in favor of the resolution. But 25 countries abstained, meaning they did not vote at all. In late July, Russia's top diplomat visited Egypt, Congo, Uganda, and Ethiopia. Lavrov accused the U.S. and European countries of driving up food prices by pushing risky environmental policies. He also accused them of keeping large amounts of food during the COVID-19 pandemic. The situation in Ukraine did additionally negatively affect food markets, Lavrov said in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia's capital. But he said food shortages were not caused by the Russian special operation or war in Ukraine. He blamed the problems on the reaction of the West and its sanctions on his country. Lavrov was warmly received in Uganda by President Yoweri Museveni. Museveni has been a U.S. ally for many years, but he has refused to criticize Russia over the invasion. Museveni even suggested at the outbreak of the war that Putin's actions might be understandable because Ukraine is in Russia's area of influence. Lavrov voiced support for reform of the UN Security Council, to give African countries permanent seats and greater influence. Museveni is considered an opinion leader in Africa and has held power for about 30 years. Russia is also trying to win African public opinion through its state television network, RT, formerly known as Russia Today. RT has announced that it will open a new office in Johannesburg, South Africa. In March, RT was suddenly removed from Africa's biggest paid television service, MultiChoice, which is based in Johannesburg. The decision came after the European Union and Britain enforced sanctions against Russia. It is not clear whether creating the new office will permit RT to broadcast again to Africa through MultiChoice. MultiChoice claims 22 million people pay for its service. For Russia, it is the battle to be heard in Africa. It is not important for the actual war effort, but for their long-term political influence, said Anton Harbor. He is a professor of journalism at the University of the Witwatersrand. On his trip to Africa, Francis Macron accused Russia of using TV channels like RT to spread propaganda in support of the war. Macron urged Africans not to side with Russia. He said, "I'm telling you here in Africa, a continent that has suffered from colonial imperialism. Russia is one of the last colonial imperial powers. She decides to invade a neighboring country to defend her interests," he said. "That's the reality." Samantha Power, the top USAID official, was in East Africa to promise aid to help the region's fight against hunger during a period of severe lack of rain. She also criticized Russia's blocking of Ukraine's grain exports and restricting the trade of Russia's own fertilizer. Power said in Nairobi that Putin's actions have caused pain to the people of Kenya and on other countries throughout the world. "He is hurting the people of Kenya," she added, "in an effort to help his own situation." I'm Ana Mateo.
As the start of the new school year gets closer, COVID-19 infections in some areas are again on the rise. Some school systems around the country have moved to hire more workers to limit disruptions. But many are hoping for the best without doing things differently compared with last year. Even some school systems that had severe outbreaks are making few changes. Among those is Baltimore County Schools in the eastern state of Maryland. The number of days that Baltimore Public Schools could not offer in-person learning totaled 116 from January to June of this year. That number comes from the private research firm Burbio. It tracks over 5,000 school districts nationwide. School officials said they did not see a need to take more measures. Charles Herndon is a Baltimore County Public Schools spokesperson. He said he does not think there will be significant disruptions this coming school year. "What we're expecting to see is waves of COVID in 2022 and 2023, and I'm sure there are going to be times when more folks are going to be absent, and there will be times when everything is okay. But the school district is prepared to move classes online if necessary. Teacher shortages remain a major concern, even bigger than COVID-19 itself, said Dan Domenech. He is the director of AASA, the School Superintendents Association. Superintendents are the leaders of school systems. That is the greater concern, that they will have the necessary staff to man all the classrooms, to man all the programs, he said. Philadelphia's schools show how disruptive the virus can be. Beginning in January, the virus caused 114 city schools to go online. That resulted in a total of 920 days of online learning, more than any other school system in Burbio's data for January through June. With shortages of substitute teachers, schools were forced to use central office workers, combine classrooms, or temporarily go online, system spokesperson Marissa Orbanek said. The district has changed hiring agencies and aims to fill 90% of substitute requests this year, said Orbanek. They also now have over 100 extra teachers. They are substitutes who show up at the same school every day in case teachers go absent at the last minute. Schools cannot afford more disruptions when many kids have fallen behind from the pandemic, said Thomas Kane. He is an education researcher at Harvard University. Students at schools in poor areas that were doing online learning for more than half a year lost equal to 22 weeks of learning, he said. Schools in wealthy neighborhoods lost only 13 weeks. We've experienced a historic widening in achievement gaps between blacks and whites, between Latinx students and whites, between high and low poverty schools, he said. Schools are hopeful disruptions will be less likely. Many districts have invested in airflow systems. Vaccines are available to children as young as 6 months old. Some of the districts that were hit hardest last year have been employing more people and making small changes to their rules. At Baltimore City Schools, which is separate from the county school system, officials say there will be more access to rapid COVID tests. In Columbus, Ohio, the school system saw 106 disruptions because of staff absences at the start of 2022. But the district did not point to any planned changes to its policies to prepare for possible increases in infections during the new year. Lolita Augenstein is president of the Council of PTAs, or Parent Teacher Associations, in Columbus. She said she is hopeful that this year will be better. The district has hired more teachers and substitutes, she said. And educators are better trained to teach online if needed. Augenstein said, kids are resilient. The families are trained in going back and forth between remote and the building. I'm Dan Novak.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Rutherford B. Hayes. He took office in 1877 and was president during the end of what Americans call Reconstruction, the period following the Civil War. Hayes had a public image as an honest, dignified man. And even though he had ideas that were radical at the time, he supported moderate policies and measured change. One exception was alcoholic drinks. Hayes banned wine and liquor from the White House. Before Rutherford Hayes was born, his father died. Not too long after that, his older brother died too. As a result, Hayes grew up mostly with just his mother and his older sister. Later, an uncle helped raise him as well. As a boy, Rutherford Hayes was called Rud. He grew up on a farm in Ohio and spent his early years playing with his sister, who taught him to love books. Hayes was an excellent student, and in time he attended Kenyon College and Harvard Law School. Hayes started his career as a lawyer in the city of Cincinnati, Ohio. He did not go into a field that made much money. Instead, he defended people who were poor or in difficult situations. He also courted the woman he would marry. Lucy Webb, like Hayes' mother and sister, strongly influenced the way Hayes thought. Hayes' own views at the time were moderate. He drank alcohol, but not much. He opposed slavery, but he was not an anti-slavery activist. His new wife, however, was strongly against alcohol and slavery. She was part of social movements at the time to ban alcoholic drinks entirely in the United States. And she encouraged Hayes to defend not only the poor in his law business, but also runaway slaves. Together, Rutherford and Lucy Hayes formed an equal marriage committed to helping others. They were known for being friendly, informal, and welcoming. They also went on to have 8 children, 5 of whom survived to adulthood. Lucy Webb Hayes said her husband was always calm as a father and took time, even when he was president, to care for his children. Because Hayes had such a positive public image, it is ironic that the contest that elected him president was one of the most hostile in U.S. history. The full story is complex, but the general story is that Hayes was the Republican candidate and Samuel Tilden was the Democratic candidate. Tilden won more popular votes across the country, but in the U.S. system, the majority of voters do not choose the president. Instead, a few electors in each state cast votes. In a way, then, the states choose the president. And in the election of 1876, 3 southern states gave conflicting reports. It was not clear whether Tilden or Hayes had won South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. Even though the election was held in November, the debate over the winner lasted until the following March, days before the new president was to be sworn in. One of the most serious accusations was that Democrats in the South had prevented many black men from voting. If those men had been able to vote, they almost certainly would have voted for Hayes. In the end, a special commission in Congress gave the votes in all 3 disputed states to Rutherford Hayes. His opponents pointed out that the majority of people on the commission were Republicans. As a result, they said, the new president had earned his position only because of party politics. They called him Rutherfraud and his fraudulency. But in the end, Hayes was widely considered an independent president who operated outside of party loyalties. One of Hayes' first acts as president was probably his most important. He withdrew federal troops from southern states. The troops had been trying to protect the civil and political rights of African Americans. But white Democrats disliked the federal government's involvement in their affairs. Also, the troops were not very effective. So Hayes said, if Southern officials promised to obey the country's laws, protecting all people equally, he would end the federal government's occupation of their states. The officials agreed, and the period known as Reconstruction officially ended. But as the years went on, the rights of Black Americans were increasingly violated. As a result, part of Hayes' legacy is one of betrayal. His policy permitted systemic violence and racism to continue for decades. Another of his important acts was to reform the country's civil service. For the most part, members of Congress offered their political allies government jobs with good pay. But Hayes sought to change the rules. He wanted to give government jobs to the most able workers. While his goal was a good one, his action shocked and angered many members of Congress. The Democrats especially sought to weaken Hayes' position by removing the president's ability to veto their bills. Hayes fought back and won. By the second half of his term, Hayes had restored some of Americans' trust in government that had been lost under the two presidents before him, Andrew Johnson and Ulysses S. Grant. He had helped ease the tensions between the North and South. He had stabilized the economy. He had increased the power of the presidency in a mostly positive way, and he had prepared the way for major civil service reform. But Hayes is not remembered as an especially great president. He is often placed toward the middle, not one of the best and not one of the worst. Some historians suggest that Hayes would be better remembered if he had stayed a second term and supervised some of the gains begun in his first years. But Hayes had promised that he would serve only one term as president. So, true to his word, Hayes did not seek re-election. Hayes had always believed that the best way to solve the country's problems was to improve the education system. So, in his retirement, Hayes became president of two social welfare organizations. One aimed to provide a Christian education to blacks in the South. One of the people helped by that organization was the well-known writer and activist W.E.B. Du Bois. Hayes also led a group aimed at reforming the country's prison system. When he was 70 years old, Hayes fell ill. Although he had a big heart for children and for helping people, he died of heart failure. Afterwards, one of his sons began a new tradition in honor of his father. He established the first presidential library. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.